In The Infinite Inning, the characterization of mercy is a contentious subject. On March 28, 1934, during spring training, in St. Augustine, Florida, there was a famous, fateful incident in the career of the future Hall of Fame infielder Rabbit Marinville. The Boston Braves were playing the Yankees, and Rabbit was in the lineup. He was 41 years old, still hanging in there on the strength of his glove, or at least his defensive reputation, at second base and shortstop. He had had a good day, too, hitting a two-run home run, which is something given that, A, he had hit all of 28 home runs in a career lasting 23 years, and B, he hadn't hit one in a regulation game since 1930. That aside, Rabbit had done almost everything you could do in baseball, playing in two World Series and winning one, getting to be a manager, however briefly and unsuccessfully, having a trademark play, his belt buckle catch, in which he'd let a pop-up glance off his chest and bounce into his glove, and establishing himself as a valuable player with five top 10 MVP award finishes, this despite being an inconsistent hitter at his best and a consistent goofball at his worst. So what do you get for the man who has everything? Well, not this. In the eighth inning of that game, one of the first exhibition games of spring training that year, Marinville was on third when the go-ahead single was hit, well, seemingly hit. The ball struck a base runner as it was headed up the middle, and Marinville, who had scored, was sent back to third. I mention that only because we're in danger, if you think about it, every moment of our lives, and there are times when we would be safely back in the dugout if not for fate taking a hand. And so Marinville was standing on third when, in another reality, he would have been more or less out of the game, unless, say, he had slipped on a bar of soap in the shower. But let us, at least for this moment, not descend completely into fatalism and paranoia. So Rabbit is back on third, runners at the corners, and the Braves decided to attempt a double steal. Manager Bill McKechnie, another future Hall of Famer, keeping things loose. Well, the runner on first broke, Rabbit headed home, and he beat the throw so easily that he came in standing up. But somehow, he got tangled up with the Yankees catcher, a kid named Norman Keyes, who never did make the majors. Marinville's left leg somehow struck Keyes in the shin guard, which was not a forgiving surface, obviously, and he went reeling away. The newspaper accounts talk about him flipping through the air somehow. He landed in one of the worst ways possible. He snapped his leg in two places, his left leg, between the ankle and the knee. The sound was audible to fans in the park. It was a pretty graphic injury, with his leg and his body pointing in different directions. For those who want medical specifics, he had suffered a transverse fracture of the tibia and the fibula. Initially, doctors said he would play again that season because there was no joint damage involved. His knee and his ankle were unaffected. In the end, though, he missed the entire season. He tried to come back in 1935, but his skills had just atrophied too much at that point, at that age. And after hitting 149 in 23 games, he finally quit, although he did play a little more in the minor leagues. The scene in that game where he got hurt was so gruesome that the two teams just said, "Forget it, we're not going to do any more of this today." Women screamed, grown men were crying. We're a little more used to seeing that sort of thing today, because if you watch enough football, you'll inevitably see an injury like that, but people then weren't prepared to see such obvious brutality. All of the foregoing is definitely true, but here's an aspect of it I'm not certain of. As Marinville lay on the ground, his leg shattered into a few different pieces, his teammates gathered around him, but they, too, were in too much shock to actually do anything for him. He was probably in shock, too, and in a great deal of pain, but in possession of his faculties, at least to some extent. Lying there, helpless, panting, he looked up at catcher Frank Hogan. I'm going to tell you more about Frank after the break. He was a big man, famous for being a big, heavy-set man. Rabbit made eye contact and, through gritted teeth, said, "Don't just stand there looking at me. Knock me out." And Hogan leaned down and punched Rabbit in the jaw. In this way was Rabbit Marinville anesthetized while waiting for the ambulance to come and take him away. In The Merchant of Venice, William Shakespeare wrote, "The quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath." Yeah, right. I'm Stephen Goldman, and this is The Infinite Inning. Welcome back to the show, the 91st show in an ongoing series. At this point in the run, we should be doing tabloid editions. That's something the comic book folks did when I was a kid, put out these oversized trim reprint collections, or mostly reprint collections. There was some fun original material in them sometimes. But from that moment till now, no one thought of what it would take to store the darn things, and possibly that's because even at that time, when the collector's market had started to assume something like its modern pre-internet shape, no one in publishing was really giving a lot of thought to whether there would be a secondary market in those things. You know, there's a peanut strip somewhere in the middle of Charles Schulz's run, possibly towards the first half, in which Charlie Brown or Linus, I don't remember which, talks about how his grandfather had reached the stage of life where he doesn't say much, he just sits around sighing and looking at his collection of big little books. That comment, I am certain, reflected on Charles Schulz's own state of mind more than anyone who was distinctly older than him, because Big Little Books originated in 1932 when he was a kid, and so that's something that he would have been sentimental about in the same way that I am now being sentimental about those giant-sized comic books. And what I'm trying to say is I probably was 6 or 7 years old when I first read that strip in some Peanuts reprint collection, but now I reflect on it all the time because at my age, I am in a position to understand precisely what he meant. Big Little Books were still a thing when I was a kid, and I have a bunch of them lying around somewhere, and I wonder how many of you understand what it is that I'm talking about when I refer to them or to tabloid-sized comic books, and how many of you might have read, say, Captain America's Bicentennial Battles and all Jack Kirby production from 1976 in that oversized format. You can buy in a bookstore now. It's since been reprinted in regular book size. It remains one of the trippiest stories I've ever read as Cap unwillingly goes on a magical mystery tour of all of American history, and it is surprisingly less unquestioningly patriotic, less jingoistic, less pleasant than you might have been led to expect from the title. But here I go again, continuing onward. I could talk about this topic for an hour, but that's a different podcast, I think. And so I will stop proving the perspicacity of Schulz's comment, draw a line here, and say that this week I'm joined by Patrick McClellan of the astrocentric Lima Time Time podcast, or is that Lima Time Time podcast? You'll hear me asking that same question later. Patrick talks about the Astros there, as well as on Houston Sports Radio. And in the course of our discussion, we cover not only the Astros' ongoing attempts to stay atop the American League West, despite some surprising uncertainties, both in the starting rotation, which remains unsettled, as well as some areas of the lineup where I at least argue they've been a little more complacent, I think, than you would expect from knowing who is running that front office. As always, we cover some other topics as well. Patrick moonlights in comedy, and we talk about what it takes to make it in that field, the aspects of it which appeal to him and those that don't. And I hope, as always, you will enjoy the whole of the conversation. Before Patrick rolls in here, a couple of more words. As I said before the theme song struck, I was going to talk more about Shanty Hogan, Frank Shanty Hogan. His full name was J. Francis, Shanty Hogan. Shanty being a nickname of uncertain origin. I'll explain that too at some point. not this week, actually, because I'm going to call an audible here and just comment on a much smaller aspect, small being something pointedly said in reference to Hogan, than I had planned to initially, because Shanty Hogan, the name may signify that he was the size of a small house. It's not true totally, but that's the way it comes down to us. And if you look at pictures of the fellow, and I will post some in our Facebook group, the Infinite Inning group at Facebook, so you can see what I mean, Hogan was, to put it delicately, a bit bloated. Officially, he was 6'1 and 240 pounds, but he was probably pushing 300 at times. He admitted to 260 on a number of occasions. And almost every story about him is about what kind of trencherman he was, just how much he ate, and the ways that he got away with eating when people didn't want him to eat. And all of those stories, I think, miss the point. They miss it in two directions. They miss something about Hogan himself, a man who did eat his way out of the big leagues, and they miss something about the people who were trying to help him, if help is even the right word. But the reason I am going to change what I wanted to discuss is simply this. Current events overtook me. There is a detail in Hogan's life that doesn't fit the trunk of the story that I just outlined to you, and I wasn't sure if I was going to mention it or just fit it in sideways, but now it's really bothering me. So let me just give you this much detail about Hogan, and then we'll pick up the larger, pardon the expression, story about him next time around. But Frank Hogan, who was from Massachusetts, just like Rabbit Marinville, came to the big leagues at first at the age of 19. In 1925, he was signed by the Boston Braves. He played in the majors from then until 1937 with the Giants, then back with the Braves and the Senators. His eating habits were an annoyance to everyone throughout. He occasionally got into scraps. Reading between the lines, I think that he drank a bit as well as ate a lot. He was a catcher at his best, capable of hitting 333, 339, 301. He had a lot of averages like that, and he hit 295 for his career. Now, you are an alert, well-informed listener, and in your easy chair or in your driver's seat right now, you are saying, hang on there a moment, Stevie. This was the late 20s, early 30s. Everyone hit 295 there, so let's not overrate this fellow's batting average. And you are totally right about that. He certainly did benefit from the environment in which he played. But that said, he was an above-average hitter for a catcher. He just wasn't an MVP kind of guy. If you want to have a comparison, I sort of think of his offensive capabilities as something like that of maybe Jonathan Lucroy in a typical season. I don't mean Jonathan Lucroy now, where he is far off of his all-star form here in his early 30s, but in 2013, when Lucroy was 27, he hit .280 with a .340 on base and a .455 slugging for the Brewers, and that was not an MVP-level season itself. It was just very solid given the offensive environment at the time. And that's what Hogan provided. He had one additional kind of deficit, which was that given his weight, he was probably, if not the slowest player in the major leagues, given that fellow catcher Ernie Lombardi was a contemporary, he was a close second, and infielders felt that they could play well back. I mean well back, like in the bleachers when he came to the plate. This is important to know, too, which is that as a personality, despite some of the issues with the way that he carried himself, literally and figuratively, he was generally depicted as being a fun-loving, loud-voiced, but good-natured kind of guy. Keep that in mind when you listen to what I'm about to tell you, because the anecdote in question, just a small thing, is not mentioned in any of the writings about Hogan. And if you read enough baseball books, I promise you, you will come across stories of Hogan and his eating. No one, not even the most junk food addicted fat man, is reducible to just one quality. And that goes for Shanty Hogan, and it goes for the governor of Virginia, too, a soldier and pediatric neurologist, who, the night before I recorded these words, admitted that he appeared in a photograph on his 1984 medical school yearbook page when he was about 25 years old, depicting two men, one in blackface, the other in Klan drag. Now, as I am speaking to you, the governor, Ralph Northam, is holding a press conference dedicated to withdrawing his admittance that that was his photo on his yearbook page. He is claiming, essentially, that his yearbook page was hacked, or whatever the 35 years ago version of hacking was when it comes to a book. Simultaneously, and this is a very strange way of trying to convince people that you're not an insensitive racist, he confessed that, although it is not, he claims, himself in blackface in the photograph, there were other occasions in which he appeared in blackface. Those occasions, well, he hopes, were not photographed. You know, the whole idea of blackface as something that white people do for their own entertainment or for the entertainment of others goes way back into the 19th century, and I have actually heard in my own lifetime white people talk about it as a respectable thing to do. And I'll tell you, I was never or have rarely been more uncomfortable than when having those discussions with seemingly otherwise sane and non-racist people. As recently as the 1930s, Amos and Andy, which was a blackface radio show, if you can imagine such a thing, with white people, white men voicing black characters, was the cultural happening of the time. It was so popular that business came to a stop when it came on. Movies were scheduled around the show rather than conflict with it because people would just not show up. And as radio declined and television came into being as a mass entertainment form, it transferred over there with black actors taking on the roles that had been originated by those white guys. And they were told to make sure that their characterization matched what the white guys had depicted on the radio. And man, that's complicated. Because you now have black actors employed in a leading television series, which is a great thing, but playing characters that had originated in minstrelsy. And that's not so good. And you can meet, or at least when I was a kid, met people who remembered that stuff, both the radio show and the television series, and resented the NAACP for inveighing against it. They eventually succeeded in driving the television show off the air. It wasn't racist, they would say. It was just funny. But the question is, where is the humor coming from and who is pointing the finger? And therefore, what social structures, positive or negative, does it serve to reinforce? Are you laughing with or laughing at? This is a massive, massive topic, a psychologically complex one. The idea of inhabiting a race that is not your race has been the subject of entire books trying to figure out what goes into that idea, and I can't do it justice here, but I will say this. It seems to me that whenever a white person decides to depict themselves in black skin, it is never for a performance that honors that other race. They never do pull out the shoe polish, which is what Northam admits that he did, in order to depict Martin Luther King Jr. or Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman, George Washington Carver, you name it. There are so many positive things that one could do in terms of honoring black Americans. But no, it's always something lower than that. It's always for the purposes of parody, not enhancement. And I'm not saying that such a performance would be possible or even correct. It probably wouldn't be. I'm just saying that the very nature of the performance gives the game away and puts the lie to any excuse that one might make. So what happened? 35 years passed for Northam. That was forgotten until a conservative group dug up the yearbook. He did many good things in his life, presumably. I alluded to the military service. I mentioned his pediatric work. And all those things do count for something. And they served to bury whatever racist inclinations he had at that time. And I don't say racially insensitive. I say racist because in 1984, people were very aware of what dressing up in blackface had as far as connotations went. In fact, the year before, PBS put out a well-received documentary called Anatomy of a Controversy that was about the Amos and Andy program and the mixed ways that people received and reacted to it. Shanti Hogan had his racist moment too, and as with the governor of Virginia, it just got washed away by the river of time, piled under other stuff, in his case, not politics or medicine, but just fat jokes, fat joke after fat joke, decade after decade, even after his passing. In 1930, John McGraw's New York Giants had a good team, not a great team. They went 87-67, finished in third place, 5 games out. Hogan was their regular catcher. He was 24 years old. He played in 122 games, hit .339, .378, .517, popped 13 home runs over the course of the season. He was useful, and his backup, Bob O'Farrell, was good enough to start in a lot of seasons. He hit .302. It was one of the assets that the Giants had, along with players like Mel Ott and pitchers like Carl Hubble. The World Series that year was between the St. Louis Cardinals and the Philadelphia A's, and wrapped in Philadelphia on October the 8th. Hogan wasn't there. He was still in New York at some kind of apartment party in West 79th Street, if you're nearby and want to look it up. And that building had an elevator operator, and that elevator operator, as most of them were at that time, was an African-American by the name of Joseph Kink, 35 years old. And by the time the night was over, Hogan was in the hospital with slash wounds, and Kink was under arrest for assault. It is not entirely clear to me from the sketchy accounts that survive exactly what happened, but it doesn't take a lot of imagination to create a reasonable seeming picture. Hogan was at that party. Kink, for whatever reason, was invited in, whether for a moment or for an hour, I don't know, but Hogan objected to his presence. That's the way it's put. I think it would be naive to suggest that Hogan's prejudice was against elevator operators and not against the color of Kink's skin. Well, whatever he said, Kink was so mortified that he lay in wait for Hogan to leave the party and attacked him. Fink apparently had some sense of irony, with a baseball bat. In the scuffle that ensued, Hogan managed to knock the bat away, at which point Fink produced a knife, and I'm not really sure how Hogan got away from that with his life still intact. Perhaps some other parties stumbled on the scene and managed to subdue the combatants. But his wounds were superficial. He went home for the winter, packed on the usual extra 20 or 30 pounds, which he had to sweat off in spring training. There was no disciplinary action by Judge Landis or anybody else associated with baseball, and as far as I know, it was never mentioned again. There were other fights for Shanti Hogan at other times, albeit not of a racist variety, some of them irrelevant to baseball, and I will talk about them next week. Shanti Hogan is long dead. He's a fringe historical figure in baseball, but as always, I find learning these kinds of things instructive, and I hope you do too. It changes my opinion of him. He's not just a figure of fun anymore, or a figure of controversy for those managers and teammates who hoped he would just drop a few pounds so he might beat out an infield single every once in a while. It's the only such incident in his life that I know about, but that in no way means that there weren't others that I'm not aware of, because very few of us have our every movement documented, but it's really not important to me whether there were more or not, because it seems to me that there are people who are capable of injuring others in this way and those that are not. And I'm not justifying what Mr. Fink did to Mr. Hogan in terms of, well, trying to kill him for embarrassing him. I'm just saying that a person whose humanity had not been corrupted by racism would not have provoked the incident in the first place. I look at Ralph Northam the same way. It might have been a long time ago, but you only get one chance to lose my trust or display certain patterns of thinking. Northam was 25 back then. Hogan was going on 25. Both should have known better. As always, mull that idea over if you don't mind. If you have thoughts or reactions of your own, I'm always eager to hear them, whether via email at infiniteinning@gmail.com or at the Infinite Inning Facebook group. Community is a part of what I am doing here. And let me just add this. In the past, my work, when I've written, I've gotten feedback from people who say, you speak so authoritatively, it doesn't brook a reply. That's a paraphrase. The person who said that was very confused because it's my job to speak authoritatively. Walter Cronkite never ended a broadcast by saying, and that's the way it was. But just because, whether as a writer or as a voice on this podcast, it's my obligation to tell you a story that has strong borders and boundaries and has some kind of fully formed argument inside of it, that I have a closed mind, or that I don't know that I can be wrong about things, or that there aren't other details or aspects to consider. Collaboration is the best part of a writer's job, and the audience is part of that. On that note, we will pause for a break, and when I return on the other side, I will be in conversation with Patrick McClellan. Please proceed with caution during this break so that you may return as well. See you then.
It looked shady. It looked very shady. You're lucky I answered.
It has actually happened to me, so I make sure to let everyone know that I'm not calling from the Police Benevolent Association, although I appreciate their service, nor am I offering a free vacation. I'm just trying to have a baseball conversation.
Which is, would upset a lot of people, honestly.
The baseball conversation?
Yeah, people don't like baseball.
Not that we've really started yet. I usually like to introduce the guests.
I like to hop right in without any note, without any
exactly. Well, let me do that, and then I want to follow up on that.
All right, cool.
My next guest is a writer, comedian, co-host of the Lima Time podcast on the Houston Astros. Did I get the time with the right inflection there, the right emphasis on the time? Lima Time, and the shift on Sports Radio 610 in Houston. His glasses put me in the mind of Elvis Costello, and I don't know if that's purposeful or not, but in my mind, that's a flattering comparison. He's Patrick McClellan. How are you, Patrick?
I'm wonderful. I will always take an Elvis Costello comparison, no matter how wrong it is.
Is it? See, now I've only seen pictures of you, and I think some YouTube video, but I haven't seen you in person, so I don't know.
Yeah, I'm going away from the glasses. It was getting too tied in. It was getting too ingrained in my brand, and I don't actually need them. It was an aesthetic thing for a while. I got bored, and I'm like, then the people were saying, like, tie in the glasses with me too much. I'm like, I don't really need these. I have very good vision, so I'm pulling away from the glasses.
I knew people, well, kids, who did that in elementary school. Like, the girls will like me better if I have that bookish and nerdy look.
Right.
And so even though they had a prescription that was maybe 1 degree off of normal, they went for it anyway. I don't know if I have had or known adults who did that.
Well, now you do.
It could be a prop, right?
Right. You just get bored with the same old thing. I do, at least. I don't like monotony, something that I'm not a big fan of. So I'm just like, I'm going to wear glasses today. And then sometimes it works, or you get a couple compliments. You're like, hey, all right. And then it rides its course.
For me, I didn't really have a look of any kind, really. I don't know if I have a look now. I don't have looks, plural, I know that. But I kind of hit upon my primary wardrobe and grooming habits and everything else when I was about 16, and I haven't really changed them. And I have a younger sister who teases me about having a uniform. I mean, I understand what you're saying about wanting to change things up, but in certain little accoutrements of daily living for me, whether it's a kind of jacket or this beard that I've had since I was a precocious, overly hirsute teenager, I feel like my identity is tied up in those things. It's not an outward-going trademark. It's more like, oh, yeah, when I look in the mirror, I know that guy.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I wish I had that approach. I just get too bored with my looks. I'm super into clothes and stuff too, so I'm kind of one of those douche guys that like super hyper into style and stuff, so I like to switch stuff up.
No, I respect that. I think I would feel strange. I would feel like a poser with the French poseur. I would feel inauthentic if suddenly, like, I was, I don't know, covered in pleather and zippers and stuff like that.
No, you should. I think I encourage everybody to cover themselves in leather and zippers at least one point. And of course, in a non-sexual way. I mean, in like a more of a motorcycle type of vibe.
Before we get to your offhand comment about people not liking baseball, I just want to say this about the Lima Time podcast. The discussion is good, and you have players on, like the actual authentic sore-armed Lance McCullers, who was on a couple of episodes ago.
Yeah.
But I think the thing that thrills me the most, and I know you probably take this for granted at this point, is the opening audio that you use every week, which is the late Jose Lima in a Casa Olay commercial where he not only sells the brand but sings the jingle. It just reminds me of how much fun he was and how sad his early passing was as well.
Yeah, he was the best. Every once in a while we'll get caught up talking, telling some stories and stuff, and I still, every time I hear that commercial, I can't not think about him eating the taco vertically. He bites into the taco holding it vertically, and I don't know how that's physically possible, number one, but I still don't know how he did that. But yeah, he'd be out all night on a bender and then come straight in and do 4 hours of sports talk radio in the morning with like John and Lance and stuff, and he's just the best. That's just had a vice that got the best of him, you know.
Yeah, he's not the first to go that way, unfortunately, and
right.
He won't be the last. I was thinking about this in terms of Forrest Whitley, the Astros prospect who missed 50 games last year,
yeah.
With what I think, I don't think anyone specified this, but I think was a drug of a...
It was Adderall,
okay. Well, there may or may not...
So that can go. That could go either way. These days with kids, I don't... That's about as normal as taking an Advil. So I'm gonna keep one eye open on it, but I'm not too concerned with an Adderall thing. You're not allowed to take it because it's hyper focus and stuff. But I mean, for being a kid on Adderall, that's not alarming to me at all.
I was going to say we should reserve judgment regardless, because addiction is difficult no matter what the substance is.
Right.
But it's not necessarily recreational, and it's not necessarily performance enhancing. It's just almost basic equipment for some kids in recent generations, which is
right.
Disturbing, but not necessarily criminal.
Exactly. And it's tough because so many kids have made it criminal to where almost everybody's taking it. It kind of undermines the people that are actually needing it. And it kind of blurs those lines too, to where, you know, who really does need it, who doesn't. And that makes it tough. But yeah, I mean, a lot of kids are on it. So I think that that's something that needs to be looked at by at least if they're going to be signing these younger kids at that age, that they're taking that because they got classes to take. So, I mean, that's something that I guess has to be looked at.
If you do have athleticism or athletic endeavors in your future, and, you know, today, baseball players, you know, from 12 or 13 years old, not necessarily whether you're going to go to the major leagues. But
you've got it.
Yeah, exactly, because it's so organized, because there's a prospect circuit for kids, and it's one of the reasons. This is a whole huge other topic. But you know that the best way not to get in trouble with that is just not to start. I'm not saying it's not a tragedy what happened to Lima, but that there's a common sense thing that seems to go missing sometimes.
Right, yeah, and I think with him, though, I think it was just as much ingrained into his whole Lima Time persona that it was, I think it all kind of, all of his facets of his life played off of each other, as sad as that is. But I think that the narcotics and all that stuff played just as much a role in how he performed on the field and vice versa. It was kind of this cyclical thing. Because, I mean, he was the same person everywhere he played. I mean, he's beloved in Los Angeles for the time with the Dodgers, and he's pretty much anywhere he pitched, he made an impact. But he was always doing his thing, and everybody knew it. He didn't really try to hide it.
What you're describing is similar to John Belushi,
yes,
or Chris Farley, where kind of the onstage and the offstage personas,
yes,
were either the same or they just got, the boundaries got lost for everybody involved.
Yes, I would. That's a perfect comparison. It's exactly what I would compare it to.
Speaking of that, and not to dwell on Lima for the whole hour, you know that Kenan Thompson has this David Ortiz impression that he trots out on Saturday Night Live every once in a while.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wondered if it's less an Ortiz impression and it's secretly a Lima impression. It seems to have a lot more in common with Lima's persona than it does Ortiz's.
Yeah, I guess it does. I'm wondering if he just, the comic effects that he played up with the comic persona he used for Big Papi, if that it just ended up being by accident, a Lima impersonation. Yeah, it's pretty dead on. Anything Kenan does is fine in my book, as far as I'm concerned.
To go back to what you were saying before we even started, it struck me because
On last week's show, too, one of my guests was saying the average demographic for baseball is aging and it's just a local thing, not a national thing. And you hear that a lot, particularly when you have this winter like we're having, where none of the owners seem to want to do anything
right
to stimulate season ticket sales or baseball conversation. And mostly it's just people like the Astros owner talking about how, no, they don't want to sign anybody because Bryce Harper and Manny Machado aren't where the value is, whatever that means. Is that the kind of thing that you were referring to?
No, I hear it so much, and I don't actually believe that the demographics are down or any of that, because I see just as many, at least, well, I guess I'm speaking from a place, coming from a current world champion city, that the youth is going to be up. You know, that people are paying more attention here. So, I mean, this may not be a good representation of how the rest of the country is, because people are more excited for baseball here, given that the Texans are flop out of the playoffs, and so that people are ready for baseball. But I get all the time when I'll be talking with somebody, I'm like, ah, what do you do? And I'll tell them I'm on radio and with baseball and stuff, and they're like, oh, yeah, I just can't get into baseball. And it's just, I hear this all the time, and from seemingly big sports fans. And I don't know if it's upbringing. I don't know. It'd be a big sociological or psychological study on what goes into being a baseball fan. Because, I mean, I played it growing up, and baseball was always around. So I don't remember ever choosing to like it. I just always did. So I don't know. I just hear that all the time, and it's just the same thing. It's just too boring. It's the same repetitive. It's too long. It's too boring. Blah blah blah.
It is very long, but I don't think longer than
it's not
anything else or any other
not
sporting event. There are as many or more stoppages in other games. Yeah, we have a problem in baseball now in the sense that there are too many three true outcomes plate appearances, right? Walk, strikeout, home run,
right,
which eliminates a lot of the athleticism, a lot of the great diving catches and the base stealing and all that stuff. So we do have a problem there. I go through cycles with football where sometimes I'm more involved with it and other times less.
Right. I'm the same way.
This year I watched a lot. You have this religious test on every play. Did it really happen or not? That's what people have been talking about with the Saints-Rams playoff game.
Yeah.
More than the coming Super Bowl. As we're speaking, it's still a few days in the future. Every play, right? The quarterback completes 30 yards downfield for a first down. No, he didn't. And we're going to take 10 minutes to figure that out. Baseball does some of that now, too, but fortunately...
Yeah, the Astros were victims of a lot of that.
You do have to wait through that, but then we ask for that, right? We ask for accuracy as well. So I'm not sure where the happy spot is for fans at this point.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just going to come down to personal preference, and I think you kind of alluded to the localized thing earlier. I think a big part of the game, at least being perceived the way it is how it is. It's so localized by region and by market. You get hyper focused on your team, and you know your prospect list, you know your roster, but you may not know who's the relief pitchers for the Pittsburgh Pirates are, or for this, or even teams that are in the same league that you don't play that often. So the baseball doesn't have a big national game right now. So you're going to be hyper focused on your division, and you're going to get that great localized coverage, but you're really not going to get, you're not going to know who the other guys are unless you go out and do your own research.
Let's be honest about this, right? Like, I feel like when I was, 16, 17, I could name every player in the major leagues. Maybe not like...
Right. Same, because, yeah.
All 25 men all the time, because those things are always changing, but mostly. And I knew most of the prospects too.
Right.
Now, I had less on my mind back then, but now it's harder. And as somebody who's professionally in this, both of us, I think we can both admit this, or maybe you're much more prepared than I am, but there are many days, because of particularly the shuffling at the back of bullpens of all the teams, you just alluded to this.
Oh, yeah.
I'll look at a box score, and Dwayne Blatherskite picked up the win for the Rockies in relief in the seventh inning, and I will go, who the hell is Dwayne Blatherskite?
Oh, I've done it for my own team. I'll just be like, who the hell? I'll be like, okay, then I have to go out, who's this Perez kid? And I have to go back and see who he is and figure this out. Yeah.
You were talking about how you're in a championship city, and of course you're now a year or more removed from that. I guess the glow is still on it, given that you guys were waiting since 1962 to get that one in. And the Astros had a great season by a lot of measures in terms of defending that. They won 103 games, by Pythagorean record, they should have been even better, maybe, but you can't really fault 103 wins regardless. Obviously, they got steamrolled by the Red Sox in the playoffs, a team that steamrolled everybody. But was it still a satisfactory sequel to the big win?
It wasn't at first, but now going back and realizing that you had Lance McCullers pitching, needing surgery, you had a dead arm, you had Correa with a hurt back, you had Altuve with a hurt knee needing surgery, Bregman needing an elbow drained, and you went to the ALCS again the next year. And I firmly believe if they didn't have those injuries, I think they would have won the pennant again and they would have won the World Series. I think that team was good enough to. Considering that, it was success, but they were just beaten up. And the Red Sox, and that's nothing to take away from the Red Sox. The Red Sox beat them. They deserve to be the world champions for sure. They had a great year. The Astros were, they were right there. So it felt like a failure, but like they won a World Series and went back to the ALCS. Like that didn't happen. That's good.
Right. No, it's much harder in this era when you don't have the reserve clause keeping players with teams for 20 years and you have multiple levels of the playoffs. It's infinitely harder to repeat than it was in the days when the Yankees won it every year, or any dynasty that you can name. It's almost impossible to do. And I think that's one reason why, say, the Atlanta Braves, that had that great almost, 20-year run with Bobby Cox. And then,
geez, that was incredible.
People say, like, well, they only won one World Series, so they're kind of like the Buffalo Bills of the baseball. No, they're not. There are just too many.
They won, like, 15 straight divisions.
Right. Exactly. And just as you were talking about with all the injuries the Astros had, entropy is constantly wearing at these teams and it's always changing. And you don't know if the person who substitutes for the last star is going to be as good. And it's almost impossible that they will be with some of those players.
Still fun, though.
That's the point, to see. And this was one of the things for me that was simultaneously frustrating and amazing about the Astros last year, was that as good as they were, the left fielders didn't hit. And even though they had Derek Fisher and Kyle Tucker around, they couldn't get those guys established, at least not during the season. Springer fell off in a big way. Right field was just okay. First base wasn't very good.
No.
DH got better at the end of the year when Tyler White started platooning over there. But overall, the offense was kind of good, not great. And they were strangely...
just Bregman. Bregman was driving in all the runs. I mean, Altuve didn't drive in runs like he did before. Correa certainly didn't drive in runs like he did the year before. It was a different team. So they got the same kind of production from all different facets of the field. It wasn't the same team at all. And I think that was what's impressive to me, that they can win in different ways. It was the pitching. The pitching held them together, and they did just enough to win. And they weren't the offensive juggernaut of 2017.
Right. The pitching was definitely amazing. And that's yet a whole other topic, because going into this next season, Dallas Keuchel hasn't been re-signed. Maybe he will be, maybe he won't be. But he wasn't exactly the same guy last year that he had been in previous years. I should mention, as I said before, that McCullers is out for the season.
Right.
So there are a lot of question marks with keeping this going. One thing that I noticed is that as great as I think the Michael Brantley signing is, because it gives them this left-handed contact hitter in the outfield, and adding Robinson Chirinos, I think, is a pretty good signing. I think the Rangers were foolish to let him go. But suddenly the lineup is kind of old. And I know, going into their age 29 seasons, I think Altuve and Springer, they're not exactly ancient, and obviously Bregman and Correa are still very young.
Right.
But you have all these other guys who are 35. Like Gurriel's 35, Chirinos is 35, Brantley and Reddick will be 32, and Reddick's not Mr. Consistency as it is. I wonder if really the moment to, for one thing, get a kid left fielder established that they missed last year will be damaging to them in the long run.
Yeah, I agree with you. They are starting to get a little bit old, but I mean, I think some of that, sometimes a couple of veteran bat can come in handy. And like Gurriel is old age wise, but his body's not worn, so he's not a major league 35, and he's still raking. He still squares the ball up better than anybody else. So Gurriel, I wouldn't count. Reddick hasn't really done anything for me. I mean, I respect him. I think he's a good player, but yeah, I think that there's enough superstar core youth wise to support that it should be fine. If they can get the production needed out of their superstars, which what didn't happen last year, then I don't think it'll be an issue at all. But then, that remains to be seen.
The thing that, from I don't know what the right word is, architectural point of view, team design point of view,
right,
it's always weird to me when a team is complacent with a given position, even if they're really good. Because as you just said, you can't know when a Correa will have an injury and basically either be on the shelf or not hit for half a season.
Yeah.
And you need that other guy to carry you. You didn't think you did in March or April, but you do. And so whenever it's like, yeah, you know, we have such a great first baseman that we can play a duck in left field, the duck is cute until you need the duck to bat cleanup. And
so the duck has to actually do so. Exactly right.
That's what worries me. And I think by extension that this whole winter is like that. The thing that Jim Crane was saying the other day about teams are very focused on value instead of Bryce Harper and Manny Machado, I feel like I heard that before when I was about to be laid off from a job. It was this NBA speak that sound. I mean, I'm not accusing them of collusion, but it sure sounds like that.
Right.
Finer things are for the finer folk. The society began. Caviar for peasants is a joke. It's too good for the average man. Supper clubs are for the upper folk, packed like sardines in a can. Through the smoke you get your check and choke. It's too good for the average man.
You're listening to the unique voice of jazz great Blossom Deary singing the Rodgers and Hart song Too Good for the Average Man from her 1960 album Soubrette. The song itself dates from 1936, and the show On Your Toes, which has been revived several times since then. The famous songs in that show include There's a Small Hotel, Glad to Be Unhappy, which I've talked about on this show, and Rodgers' great instrumental Slaughter on 10th Avenue. And I think this is the only version of the song that has been recorded outside of Cast album. But this celebration of snobbery seemed to fit an off-season when baseball teams keep telling the ticket buyer, the fan, that they can't have nice things. We'll pause here so we can all have a moment to grab some libation, walk the dog, and kiss the cat. And then I'll be back on the other side with more conversation with Patrick McClellan. Be careful until then, okay?
For the mass, it's too good for the average man. Rich old age can blossom like a rose. Plastic surgeons have a plan.
Comedian is on your biography, and that's as hard a path to success, a ladder to success, as is being a full-time writer, which was my route. Where are you on that ladder?
I've been doing comedy for years. It's something that I enjoy doing. I don't do stand-up as much as I used to anymore. It's just not too fun for me, but I still am around the scene a bunch and produce some shows and help out and I still do some writing. I'm working on a cool little pilot for a comedy, a sitcom actually based in in the analytics portion of a Major League Baseball team, kind of the math nerds around the jocks. I think we've got some good stuff going on with that. So I'm messing on with that. But yeah, it's something that I like to make people laugh, and I'm not happy if I'm not doing it. So just something that I always mess with, never kind of go too far away from. I use stupid characters and bits on my radio show and stuff every once in a while. So they're just kind of all intertwined. I'm a man of chuckles, man of many chuckles.
There's a T-shirt right there, the man of chuckles, or the man of 1,000 chuckles. Maybe you wouldn't want to have a finite number of chuckles.
Yeah, you don't want to put a finite number on the chuckles. Yeah, because it sounds good. It does have a better ring to it though. Or a million chuckles.
A million, right? Well, you have a higher ceiling then.
Yeah.
I've known people in that field, and sometimes they might have started in stand-up, they might have started in improv, and maybe the goal was to be stars themselves to end up with,
right.
Well, nowadays it's a Netflix special, I guess. It used to be an HBO special.
Yeah. Well, now you just have to be in comedy to get one of those now, apparently.
Is it a question of doing the hours behind a mic on a stage and getting the reps in and bombing and the kind of stuff that the old guard talks about in terms of the rite of passage? Or is it now, because it's a more connected world, doing YouTube stuff and sort of just networking and who you know,
right,
that gets you those kinds of opportunities, say, to pitch a sitcom?
Well, I mean, you have to. Well, I think what makes the old guard so mad is that you can seemingly skip all of the putting in the man hours, which is actually necessary. You can't get good unless you're going up and bombing and doing these, going up 5 to 10 times a week. And I mean, that's necessary stuff you got to do. But these days, and it's starting, I've seen it backfire multiple times, but like somebody with a successful YouTube channel has gotten a spot on, you know, the Montreal Just for Laughs Festival and then just bombed because they've never actually done stand-up before.
I think I know what you're referring to, too.
So there is a chance to bypass, you know, it's just, but you have to really have the goods.
So what aspect of stand-up put you off of stand-up?
I just don't like it. What I don't like about it is, this kind of harkens back to the monotony thing with me and my clothes. I don't like, it would bore me to just perfect my act and say the same joke every week. Like, where you go on autopilot. Like, I would get excited by just going off the rails and just seeing where it would take me. So like, it was just kind of like the structured, you do your act and you get it perfect, you know, you get your act perfect and you do your 5 minutes, you do your 10 minutes, you do your 15, you know, and I got bored doing that. And then, but so there's no way to really grow if I'm going off the rails every time. It may be terrible, it may be good, but you don't really grow from that. So the only way to really get your act better is to keep doing it, perfect it. So it was just kind of like a vicious cycle that I just didn't like. I get the itch every once in a while where I just want to go just talk to some people, but you know, I do that on the radio, so that's fine.
Right. If you have the desire to be on stage, I don't think it matters what your venue is. There's no
right
way or wrong way. The funny thing is, I would think that improv would be kind of a corrective to what you said, but then every improv show I've ever seen had the same games and the same setup. Right. So even though it's supposed to be totally random and everything, in certain senses, it's actually very controlled. At least that's my amateur impression of it.
I completely agree. Yeah, improv never, the idea of improv excites me a great deal, but the actual implementation and doing it is exactly what you just described. And it's usually just the theater nerds. And God bless the theater. I love it. And God bless the theater nerds, but there can be insufferable. And it's hard to deal with sometimes.
And yet a lot of people come out of Second City and the Groundlings and stuff like that and have success, I think, doing exactly that. So there's something,
right,
something about it that seems to prepare people in the same way that doing 1,000 lame clubs as a stand-up does.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Well, but Second City and those places like UCB and those theaters, I mean, those are legendary places. So there's going to be some talent groomed out of there for sure. But yeah, I mean, no, there's great improv is incredible, but the rest of the improv kind of falls flat. And it's kind of hard to see. If you ever go see a show at one of those places, you'll be like, oh, okay, this makes more sense.
I've heard actors who do plays, and, you know, you're doing, what, 9 a week or something like that if you have a successful play, like
right,
6 nights and 2 matinees or so, 8 or 9 a week. And I've heard them say that after a while, and I don't know if this is the good actor saying this, but you become so accustomed to the rhythms of it that you're not really totally mentally present. And, you know, by the 50th.
Oh, for sure.
As you're just waiting for kind of the spaces where you know you're going to talk. But in the meantime, you could mentally be like, when I get out of here, I got to go to the grocery store and pick up a ham.
Yeah.
But on stage, you're like, what do you mean you slept with my sister? But inside, you're just about ham. And I always wonder with stand-up if it's the same thing.
Autopilot. You go on autopilot because, I mean, you've said the same bit a million times, you know, word from word, and you literally can zone out while you're saying a bit and being like, ah, oh, man, look at that guy's weird hat in the second row. Oh, I'm gonna need to get gas when I pull out of here. I mean, you could just go over a laundry list of stuff, but yeah, it's the same kind of thing. And that's when you're doing that, I mean, that's like, you need to reevaluate stuff because you're checked out, whether you're trying to be or not. You can't help it.
So if you're somebody like, I'm going to name a legend here, but like George Carlin, who did it for like, what, 40 years or something, and did thousands of shows, how do you stay fresh?
That's a personal, question. Not doing it. It was my thing. Just not doing it. Oh, you always, I mean, if you like to write jokes and stuff, I mean, yeah, you know, I'll tweet and stuff. Like, there's always an outlet. So you always get your outlet for writing your stuff down. Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to even have a definition because everybody, the way they approach it is going to be, you know, somewhat different depending on what they love or what they, because I know, because I have good friends that are really good comics that are still hitting their 5 to 10 mics a week and they won't miss it and they're always working stuff out and that's just, and they do their shows on their weekends and they're happy. That monotony above it doesn't bother them at all.
Well, it's an interesting, I as a writer, I have the same problem because I've been doing this like 20 years and I said at some point, I don't want to write any more updates about Groin Pulse. Let somebody else do that. Like I tend to write features and I tend to write historical things or political things or whatever. And I keep a finger on baseball all the time, but I write things that make me happy.
Right.
I don't care about that.
That's great.
Last reliever. Right, but the market may not want that from you. That's the hard part. And so I get that. I totally get that. And I saw George Carlin, a couple of times. And each time that I was fortunate enough to see him, he did some combination of new bits, but he also did some greatest hits.
Right.
I didn't mind seeing the greatest hits the same way that if I go to see a band, I expect them to play the songs that I know.
Right.
So there's a combination of wanting to be surprised and wanting to be familiar. But as I'm talking to you now, he did one of those bits that went back to, I don't know, the 70s or early 70s or something. He couldn't have been there. He had to have been checked out. He was just saying these words that he knew by heart and waiting for the laughs, and I'm sure he was happy that he got the laughs.
Right.
But the reason I bring this up is not because that's surprising, but it's interesting from the point of view of us talking into a microphone or writing or whatever. What is a realistic expectation to have of your, whether it's a sports guy or anything else, of their engagement? Like, if they're fooling you with their engagement, that should be good enough for you, right?
Yes. Right. Yeah, I think so.
But if a baseball player has that moment and doesn't run out of ground ball, then we're all over him for not being a gamer and not being a team player and stuff like that.
I you know, I really try not to get on guys for stuff like that. And that might be just a conscious choice to be to go counter with it. But I just don't, that stuff doesn't really bother me because there's always an explanation. I don't know. I think there's people try to paint these guys as they're either villains or they're not. And I just don't see it like that. I think everything's blurred and everybody's sometimes a villain, sometimes not. But I don't know, just a side note on that. Yeah, I don't like to criticize players for doing stuff like that. I don't like to criticize players other than they didn't perform well. I have a rule that I never say that a player will sucks or anything like that. But anybody who does a sport that, or does something that I can't do. So I get real mad at fans and people, especially on the internet. We're just like, oh, this guy sucks. He's the worst. And he's the worst. Really? I don't know. I'm sorry. That was a diatribe that I didn't mean to go on.
No, it's diatribes is part of the deal or are part of the deal. I think that's important because realistically out of the 1,000 or so players that we see every year, how many of them really are phoning it in? How many of them really don't want to succeed? And there's an assumption.
No, probably none of them.
Yeah, even if it's just greed, that's what you have to do to succeed, right? But I don't think that's what it is. And we make an assumption that is unfair, which is that a player can either get a hit on demand or make an out on demand based on their mood. And if they make an out or run into an out by stealing a base at the wrong time or bunting at the wrong time or whatever, that they're intentionally screwing it up. But I think it's actually the opposite.
Right. Yeah, I completely agree with you.
Are there players on this current iteration of the Astros that attract that kind of fan negativity in terms of, we love 24 of the guys, but this 25th guy, we're not totally comfortable with him?
No. And that's one of the great things about this Astro team and the past couple of years is that they all genuinely love each other and they genuinely want to win. They care. I mean, the city would be behind them no matter what because they brought a World Series, and so they're heroes no matter what. But it's not only that they did that, it's how they do it and how much they love playing the game and like how hard Alex Bregman works. And it's not a show. Like, this guy, like, literally all he cares about is baseball and being a good baseball player, and he's going to be a superstar because of it. Yeah, so no, these guys are, as a group, are very, very likable and like each other. And I'm almost to the point where I look at free agent signings or trade deals and people coming in and how, like, and how they could affect the camaraderie and whatnot. Like, people who talk about Bryce Harper. I'm not a big fan of Bryce Harper. On paper, does he make your lineup better? Yeah. Well, did he give you production in right field? Yeah. Get rid of Reddick, all that stuff. But if he is as unlikable as I've read, what does he do to that clubhouse?
How far back do you go with the Astros fandom? Was that something that you were born into?
Oh, yeah. I was actually in a newborn carrier as Nolan Ryan threw a no-hitter in the dome. I was at the Mike Scott no-hitter clincher against the Dodgers in 85. I was brought into it. Yeah, long-time Astros fan.
So you go back to Jose Cruz and Denny Walling and Phil Garner and almost or close to that.
Well, those were just, I was just a kid. I guess with this organization, you had to, like, they, like, forced us to go back. I mean, of course, we love Cruz. But, so I was 10, 11, and 12 for those early 90s teams where we had to deal with the Braves.
Right.
Pretty much all the 90s was in my baseball, in my young and my teenage baseball years.
So Craig Biggio is right in your wheelhouse, for example.
Yeah. So Craig Biggio, Biggio and Bagwell, those guys came up. Those were right. Those were the guys.
I'm from the New York area, and Derek Jeter was obviously a god here. And Jeter extended his career maybe a little bit longer than his shelf life should have been to pile up some of those big hits totals, particularly as his defense declined. Well, it kind of declined right from the beginning. But Biggio is another player who...
He did it too.
Yeah, and he really wasn't very useful to the team or a lot of fun those last couple of years, but they were just trying to get him over 3,000. And don't get me wrong, I enjoyed Biggio a great deal.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not saying that I wasn't a fan, but I wasn't a fan of that because it's self-centered and not team-oriented. But how did people there receive it?
I mean, I agree with you because it's so contrived. But also, those teams, not much was going on. So it was like and this was very Drayton McClain-esque type baseball to have just sitting around the good old boy Craig, come in here, get bobbleheads, so it'd be empty, Craig Biggio, bobblehead night, and we get 55,000 people or however many people we held, 40,000. Yeah, I don't like it either because it's just not organic. There's just something about it that's just off, and it's fair, you're getting them, you're in a major league game, but there's just something about it doesn't sit right with me. But he deserved all those hits. I mean, he deserved it. So, nothing to take anything away from him. But I'm kind of with you where something just didn't feel right about it. Gratuitous or I don't know what the right word is.
Well, it's supposed to be a meritocracy, right? The players who play are supposed to be the players who can help. And he was playing on reputation. And there's kind of a contrast in that. Most players don't do this, but there's the Joe DiMaggio example where, 1951, he was 35 or whatever he was, and he said, oh, I've slipped a little bit, bye. Like, no one's going to see me ground out to shortstop over and over again. I'm either hitting 350 or I'm going home.
Right.
And that seems like the platonic ideal of it, but it almost never happens.
Yeah, and that's got to definitely be the rarity. It's hard too because you got to think that, and Craig was a big competitor. So if you can still seemingly play at that level, you're not going to not play,
Right.
It's easy to look at it like, I've just compiled the stats because I want to get in the Hall of Fame. But also, if you're an athlete, it's already a fleeting dream. You start with your body and all that stuff. So I don't blame anybody who can perform to play. If they're gonna start you at second base or whatever, yeah, go for it. Not second base, whatever, he was center field, whatever the hell he was doing at that time, who knows.
Yeah, he bounced around a little. There was 1 year of second base and 1 year sort of a
Jeff Kent, he's all our good old Jeff Kent. God, I hate that guy.
why do you hate Jeff Kent?
He's just one of the most smuggest people.
He was good
on earth. He's a well and he well he's a he was very good. and he's a hero here. He had a big home run in the postseason, or World Series home run, and people just love him. He's just always a jerk. And I never forgave him for it. So just my side note on Jeff Kent. I saw it firsthand that he is in fact a jerk. that's fact. That's factual. So but I won't take it away from him. He's a good second baseman, and he's the all time home run leader, best power hitting second baseman of all time.
As fans of a team, right, I would think there's extra pressure on you because you're reaching a lot of people in that market.
Right.
To take a position on players when a player helps a team win, but rubs you the wrong way for whatever reason, what is our obligation there? Or for that matter, as broadcasters, because, okay, I mean, sometimes you're in the clubhouse and you know a guy is a jerk, as you just said.
Right.
But if he's driving in a run every other night, do you just shut up?
I think yes. I've gone record on the radio saying that, like, I don't root for evil. I don't like bad people. I'm against it. That being said, if the real devil from real hell was pitching and closing out games for the Astros to win a World Series, I'm going to support the real devil. <It's> like, on the field only is what it is.
My own point of view is I don't want to be entertained, and baseball isn't entertainment, by people that, for whatever reason, I don't find entertaining.
Right.
But I also think it's a valid point of view to say it's a bottom line game and I don't want to know what the guy's up to outside of the foul lines, and I don't care. I only want to win. I don't personally agree with it. Like, logically, I also can't wholly fault it. And that's always been a weird dividing line that people argue about
right,
whether it's in art or in acting, whatever, where you separate the off-the-field life from the on-the-field life.
You can't. And you can't separate it as much as you want to. I can say all that stuff about the devil and stuff or not, but if it really comes down to it, you can't separate it. I think there's various degrees that you can, but at the end of the day, if somebody's a terrible person, if somebody's like eating human flesh, they can't. I don't care if they hit career 370. Like, they're this flesh eater.
Well, so what? So this
can't get past that.
The system will filter them out eventually, or are you saying that there's a line that everyone has to draw? It's just maybe higher than where we've drawn it.
Yeah, I think that everyone has to. You have to be somewhat. You have to have a somewhat decent moral aptitude. Otherwise, I don't care how good you are. I think maybe those lines get blurred on minor stuff. You know, some DWIs here and there, or some stuff like that. I think if you're really good, that you can kind of get away with some, a little bit more. But when you're getting into some really deep moral questions, I don't think anybody escapes that. I think you're either good or you're bad, and that's, unfortunately, it affects baseball the same way it does everything else, every other aspect of life.
And even there, it's a question of extrapolation, right? Because the DWI is just a traffic ticket until you hit a school bus, and then
right,
it's something else. So the crime of potential is worse than the crime in actuality sometimes, and I think that's why we police that so hard.
Right.
And I'm not saying you have to know the answer, Patrick. I'm just saying, if you look at that guy and say, oh, he's got problems and he's got 30 home run power, he can help us and we can help him, or do you just say, like, he's corrupted and we don't want that? And
but it depends how like truly altruistic that we can help him part is. You know, like, cause, I mean, everybody could say that, but do you really, like, mean help him, or are you just eyeing those home run numbers and saying, like, or do you really just not care? Which is usually the case. Like, I don't care. Yeah, it's not good. I don't support it. But if he's gonna hit 30 home runs, we have a power hole right there. We have a hole in power hitting right there in that spot. We can really use it. So it really comes down to what your goals are and what you want.
I forget to do the little ordinary things that everyone ought to do.
Welcome back to 1934, the year the Detroit Tigers and St. Louis Cardinals contested for the World Series title, Pepper Martin running mad on Mickey Cochran, and the song The Very Thought of You, a real classic from that year, which originated overseas in England, where they presumably didn't care a whole lot about the World Series. This is Ray Noble, the author, and his orchestra, and the vocal is by Al Boley, who, I will just throw in here as a way of bringing the room down, was killed by a German bomb 7 years later. He was a civilian, but there was terror bombing going on by the Luftwaffe. The song rapidly crossed the Atlantic and became a hit, courtesy of Bing Crosby, I believe, and has subsequently been recorded by everyone from Nat King Cole to Tony Bennett, Ricky Nelson to Paul McCartney. I know we're speaking in metaphors, but truly, if the very thought of anyone really knocks you off your pin so completely that you no longer do the things you should do to take care of yourself, it's not a healthy thing. Get some perspective. I'm going to get some perspective by taking a quick break. You do the same, and then we'll return to wrap our conversation, our, you and me, you're part of this, I'm representing you here, with Patrick McClellan. I'll see you on the other side, I hope.
I keep thinking, by the way, that nowadays it would be fine if you signed Albert Bell, where he's still playing. And sure, he might throw a baseball at a fan in the stands every once in a while, but we have netting that goes all the way around now, so it doesn't matter as much. I don't think that that's the right attitude exactly.
Yeah.
One last note on this before we finish. When the Cubs won and I saw Aroldis Chapman on the mound finishing out those games, it took something away from it for me. And maybe I'm saying that because I'm not a Cubs fan.
Right.
Not exactly an anybody fan at this stage. I'm just a baseball fan. But it's the general feeling of it, the gestalt of it.
What, it felt wrong?
Yeah, because I can't 100% commit myself to feeling good about somebody I don't feel good about.
I don't think you were alone in that sentiment, though, with Chapman, specifically Chapman. But he was. But he's somebody that we know, like, we know he's bad. It wasn't like gray area, or like we know something happened. Like, we know details and repetitive details. Chapman's not a good dude, or at least wasn't in those instances, as nice as I can be.
So, in other words, even your statement about Hitler playing right field, that has its limitations.
Right, right. That's hyperbole. But, I mean, but at the same time, I mean, there is some truth to that, because you can, I think for your team, that you are at least more open to something if it does mean winning. I guess it just depends what kind of fan you are. I don't know. It's tough. I like to make that joke, but now when we're talking about it in a serious manner, I'm like, well, do I really? Because I like to win the right way, too.
Right. It's an interesting thing to interrogate, and you don't want to make too big a commitment to the laundry, right? And that, you know, the famous Jerry Seinfeld line, you know, we root for the laundry because of trades and free agency, and the fact that none of these guys are really from Houston, or most of them are not, or are not really from
right.
Cleveland. They're not so... You don't want to make such a big commitment to the logo. I mean, that's what comes up with Indians fans, right? I just mentioned them. They're so committed to the uniform that they will wear a racist symbol, at least up through this year, and defend it because it's my team, right or wrong. They lose that perspective. And
right.
At that point, your fandom goes from being a positive thing where it makes your life more inclusive to a negative one where you're turning it outward at other people and it becomes a negative one. It's a strange thing that we've kind of stumbled into here.
Yeah, fandom is a very mysterious beast.
And on that note, we are 2 weeks roughly from pitchers and catchers.
Yeah.
Just about all the free agents are still out there except for, well, Michael Brantley, who you guys have, who the Astros have. Are you looking forward to it, even with all the ambiguity about the season coming up?
Yeah, absolutely. I do believe that Dallas Keuchel returns. He'll be here.
I hope he does. Some of the top 100 prospect lists, or all of them from the major publications, have been released. And the Astros have a bunch of guys on there, most of whom are pitchers who are ready now. But we haven't really seen them integrate young pitchers into that rotation yet. So that might be a challenge going forward, whether Keuchel comes back or not.
Yeah, there's the good thing about the way that the Astros set it up is that there's a ton of depth. So you lose McCullers. Well, Colin McHugh had a great year last year, was a frontline starter for years before that, is going to come back in, and he's a guy with potential to be a very, very productive starter for you. You've got Brad Peacock, who had given you good innings, and then you have a slew of guys, of young guys like Josh James and Perez and Forrest Whitley, guy, all these young guys coming up. So I mean, so signing Keuchel would mean that there would only need two spots to film, and McHugh is going to seemingly get one of them. So they're not in as bad a shape as it looks like. just because of their depth. And they stand, you still have Verlander and Cole up top, so you're going to be all right.
They have one of the smarter management setups in baseball, including some good friends of mine, so I'm looking forward to seeing how they integrate all that. The podcast is the Lima Time, mm-hmm. and the show is The Shift. My guest has been Patrick McClellan. Thank you so much for dropping by, Patrick.
Oh, Tom, thanks for having me, man. Anytime. I'd love to talk some good deep baseball talk.
By mercy, love, and pity, we have come to the end of another show. You can follow Patrick McClellan on Twitter at PMcClellan. He saved you a bunch of letters. As for me, you can follow me at Go Stephen Goldman. Why Go Stephen Goldman? Because wherever it is I'm going, it's likely warmer than it is here. You can write us, by which I mean me, at infiniteinning@gmail.com. And there's a Facebook group. Go to Facebook, search Infinite Inning, knock. I will let you in. And hey, we need some life of the party discussion stimulating kinds of folks in there. Might that be you? If you are generously inclined and want to spur this show on to even greater heights, you can support it by going to patreon.com/theinfiniteinning. Finally, if you have a free moment, please go to the podcatcher of your choice and rate, review, and subscribe. It does help the show gain attention. And if your podcatcher doesn't allow you to do those things, well, I suppose you could organize a march. Our theme song, which you are listening to now and have in fact been listening to throughout the course of the episode, is called The Infinite Man, and it was a co-composition of myself and Dr. Rick Mooring, who reminds you that when baking, never forget your egg wash, lest you have to deal with the social stigma of incredibly pale pretzels. Well, if the little girl in the big wig with dreams of small stardom doesn't sing The Sun Will Come Out Tomorrow, thereby throwing off the schedule and causing me to book a vacation at the wrong time, I'll be back next week with more tales and discussion from inside the Infinite Inning.